I think I can describe myself as being very passionate about things I do. I'm energetic and involved. I'm friendly and caring.
Well, welcome to the podcast of the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. I'm Dr. Mel Spiceman, and today we'll be interviewing Matilda Dorotic, who has been so kind to be on the podcast all the way from Norway. And Matilda and I met live in Boston when I was there for the American College of Physicians meeting internal medicine this year. I spent a few days at Harvard University, and Matilda was a visiting professor at Harvard at the time. And I wanted to speak with her about her views on artificial intelligence and medicine. And you may wonder, well, how did I even find Matilda? And at the time, I had been networking and connecting with Leo Anthony Celli, who is a world-renowned expert in artificial intelligence and medicine. And not only is he a professor at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, where he rounds in the ICU on a regular basis, all of that data from his ICU goes to his lab at MIT, where he's also a professor, and he hosts for the world an open source data from that ICU of Beth Israel Hospital, which is called the MIMIC dataset, which he has been so gracious to share with the world, and thousands upon thousands of vitally important papers in data science and artificial intelligence have emerged from that lab group. And Matilda happened to have been both at Harvard and at MIT working with Leo and others on artificial intelligence. And so that's the backstory of how we met. But Matilda, can you give us a little background on what your current title is in Norway, what your background is in your training, and then how you got involved with the area of artificial intelligence in general and then in healthcare more specifically?
Thank you, Mel. Thank you for having me in this podcast. I am an associate professor at BI Norwegian Business School. I am a social scientist. And as a social scientist, I am extremely interested in the impact of artificial intelligence, both on individuals, but also on societal well-being. And in that area, in that context, I have been working with several labs, institutes like MIT, Harvard, but also United Nations police headquarters here in Norway and around other European countries, on the impact of high-risk AI applications on individual and societal well-being. When I'm saying high-risk AI applications, for example, I'm working with United Nations on the how do we implement AI, for example, in law enforcement, in very high-risk healthcare, for example, settings, in such a way that we are at the same time able to protect human rights and create trustworthy AI solutions. So that's a little bit of the background for me. I am. I have been truly pleased with the opportunity to be a research affiliate at MIT, and the fact that AI research has been in a recent year, let's say, has been really opening up to interdisciplinary approaches, where we have seen that only technical solutions are not enough, that we need to team up with the professional experts in fields like yourself, with physicians, also with social scientists, with psychologists, computer scientists, in order to create truly responsible and trustworthy AI solutions.
Exactly. I love your last point so much, because the way I've approached artificial intelligence and medicine from day one, and the whole purpose and mission of our college, is to create collaborations in such a way that we implement artificial intelligence to improve patient care by combining physicians who work alongside computer scientists and who work alongside leaders and thinkers like yourself about the guardrails, the ethics, the safety. So this whole notion of a collaborative team working on AI for good to help patients has been the basic premise of what I do. And so I spent the last year pulling together these different stakeholders, so to speak. So there's a fairly equal balance between physicians that work on projects with us, computer scientists, and thought leaders like yourself, healthcare leaders, others in government that want to make policy. So you and I have had very nice discussions around this. That's why I really wanted you to be one of the early people that we get in on the podcast. The other thing that we want to do on the podcast is make it global. So actually, one of our first people we interviewed was a woman from Malaysia that I met at an artificial intelligence conference, a physician. But like yourself, she really is looking at it from a collaborative perspective. And like yourself, she actually, even though she's a practicing emergency physician, did advanced training at a business school on global business in a way where she can use those tools to do the same things you and I are trying to do, which is look at implementation for society's well-being. So
indeed, I applaud that. I applaud that. I think that we actually, all of the developments very much depend on stakeholders' insights. And the insight you can get only by experience that you have in a certain field. So not having experience and trying to simulate what someone else may have experienced is not the way to go. So it's only through this multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder kind of merging of experiences and views from different angles is that we can get a more holistic picture about how to approach some of the big problems or phenomena.
Right. And I do want to say that you, like yourself, I've spoken to so many world experts on AI, and honestly, I have not met anyone who has better insight on the collaborative nature of doing this than you. And I love our conversations together. Specifically, let's talk about your research exploring the contextual differences of how users evaluate different type of AI applications. What can you tell us? What are your insights in that regard?
So it is interesting to think about how we have approached the evaluation of AI. Very often we are talking about technical solutions, and we often think that technical solutions are neutral. But they're never neutral because they always depend on how people evaluate them. And the adoption, implementation, and acceptance of any solution, AI or non-AI solution, will very much depend on how people evaluate or trade off costs versus benefits. And now, in that context of how people evaluate costs versus benefits, we actually see that exactly the same technical solution can be very differently perceived relative to the context or the area in which that solution has been implemented. So, for example, what we looked at is how different types of AI solutions, both in commercial settings, but also in public settings, with initially the same technology, are perceived by end users, by consumers, by citizens, by patients, when they are applied in different contexts. And what we have found is that benefits versus costs and how we evaluate benefits versus costs is very different between commercial services between and public services. And within public services, between services that we perceive as directly influencing us versus services that that are social in mind. Let me give you concrete examples. What we have found is that in commercial AI applications, like many of the applications that we have in apps, in our mobile phones, etc., people very often evaluate benefits very highly, and they undermine any type of costs, extraction of the data, many of the negative aspects that come from those applications. At the same time, very similar applications in public contexts, let's say app that is used not by you individually on your phone, but let's say by city council or immigration service, the same app would be very differently evaluated, where we will only look at or major in at a kind of mostly look at the costs and undermine the potential benefits. What we see is that in the public applications, the evaluation seemed to be very much driven by the cost perceptions, which are very different relative to which type of application we are talking about. In healthcare, for example, we very differently evaluate robots used in healthcare applications versus remote healthcare access, because we think that in a remote healthcare access, we only see the benefits to us of remote access to healthcare information. But with the robots, what we see is the fears that we, or we show the fears that we have against robots replacing humans in the care with the patient. So many of the applications are very differently evaluated relative to which context they are applied in.
Thank you. So the interestingly, if you look at what is happening in terms of publications on AI and healthcare, and you look at a lot of the work that's being done in the US and even worldwide, there's a lot of focus not actually on the part that I'm working on, which is what is the evidence-based medicine of implementing a specific AI for a patient care. But most of the energy is actually on governance, regulation, prevention of bias, and this is an extremely important area. The best people that I know that are doctors in America that work in this AI and medicine space, which you know them as well because you work with them just as I do, they actually have chosen to spend the majority of their time and their research on issues of bias, preventing bias, identifying bias, and also on things relating to regulation and governance. And this is a very complex topic that you and I could talk about and have for hours. I don't want the podcast to last that long. So I'm going to be very focused in the topics that this is a very broad area, but I know you are an expert in this more than anyone that I actually know on the planet. So let's be very specific. Let's first talk about tenets of AI regulation. So what are the main tenets of AI regulation? And I want you to think about this globally, not even just for any one nation.
So I'll start by addressing your comment. Why is it that particularly in academia and as well as on a, at the top level of regulatory institutions, UN, etc., many people are so much focused on the risks side of AI? It's because if you think in terms of the commercial applications, there is not such a strong incentive to actually think beyond the selling of the solutions benefits. But it's the other side, those who do not have direct conflict of interest, that are in particularly concerned about the risks that some of those solutions have. So we do need a very balanced view. I am not against AI. I want to say that very, very clearly. But many of us working in the area of responsible AI, AI guidance, regulatory insights, are concerned that rush in and break things is not the best approach. Historically, it has been shown that it's easier to kind of prevent then try to fix something once it's broken. So this is the aspect that I personally believe is very important for the humanity in general, to try to think about finding the balanced view about what do we know from the side of the benefits as well as from the sides of the costs. Now, going back to some of the tenets of regulation, they're dealing with some of those basic risks to individuals that some of these applications are emphasizing in reality. And these tenets are data privacy issues, the issues of the protection of the individual data that we have, and the problem of extraction of the data and the unlawful use of the data. The second thing that is a very important tenet in all of the regulations around the world is the wish for non-discriminatory solutions. So for solutions that would be fair towards all of the people that may be affected by a certain solution, and solutions that should be fair globally. So if we think about a global view of the AI, it's very few countries and very very few nations that are actually driving most of the benefits and most of the developments of AI. And then the global majority that does not have a seat at the table, but are also taking lots of the risks and lots of the costs, environmental costs, data costs, human rights costs, etc., from some of these developments. So the non-discrimination is another aspect that is really important. And there are two more aspects that I would emphasize. It's the question of transparency, trying to understand in two directions this tenet is going, trying to understand what the model is doing in order to create the solution, which is called explainability, but also to that explainability, just we are adding much more the transparency of how outcomes of the certain solution may impact the user. What are the potential benefits and what are the potential harms that user may foresee from using a certain AI solution? And finally, one of the most contested tenets is liability and accountability for the harms. Who is going to be liable for potential harmful effects of AI applications in many different contexts? And how can we deal with that liability to try to make firms accountable for some of the things that they could be accountable for, but also they cannot be accountable for things that they do not have any control over or that are beyond their expertise. So these are some of the main aspects that all of the regulations around the world use currently.
Great. And I want to circle back to the last part of what you said. So I'm internal medicine, and in the U.S., our Organization for Internal Medicine, the professional society, is called American College of Physicians. And a few months ago, they released a kind of policy statement that addresses the types of things you talked about. But I want to go back to the collaboration. So the person who wrote that policy statement for our American College of Physicians, which I've been a member and a fellow of for decades, I got to meet her at the national meeting in Boston right after I met with you. And her name is Nadia, and she is a JD. She's a trained as a lawyer. And our organization has her there full time doing this AI policy for the American College of Physicians. But she wrote that in collaboration with a physician who I also had the chance to meet, who's a professor in the California area, an academic physician, and a JD, an attorney who has training like in healthcare policy, collaborated with a informatics committee within the organization in a wonderful way to come up with the kinds of things that you were just discussing. Now, I was at the radiology conference here in Chicago. It's called RSNA, and it was in its 111th year, and it's held in McCormick Place, Chicago, which is the largest convention center in America. And we're going to have, meaning our organization, American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine, we're going to have our national meeting this year in September 19th and 20th at that same place, the McCormick Place, which is where most of the major medical conferences in the U.S. are held. But the reason I tell you that is when I went there in December, just last month, literally 4 weeks ago, in their exhibit hall, there were about 1,000 FDA-approved AI as medical device algorithms. But not only were they there, they were ready and available for implementation. And not only that, most major medical centers in America are implementing these algorithms right now, this year, 2025. Now, the reason that I went to the radiology meeting, even though I'm internal medicine, is 75% of those 1,000 algorithms are for radiology imaging. And the other 10% are for the heart. And the heart meeting, American College of Cardiology, is at the end of March, right here again in McCormick Place. So I'm very well positioned in Chicago. But where I'm going with this is, in the U.S., the FDA regulates medication. And as doctors, we only would give you a medicine if we know it was studied in a randomized trial and it was safe. Mm-hmm. And you and I are talking about guardrails and safety for the public. We view as really critical. These 1,000 FDA-approved AI as medical device, they haven't been subjected to the kind of pressure that is for medication. So a big push, and one of the major focuses of our organization and the research arm, is the evidence-based medicine.
Indeed.
Like a drug where there's proven in scientific studies, because you and I are scientists, that it's safe and effective. So even though that hasn't been proven yet, and I'm leading a movement nationwide amongst academic physicians to do that kind of work, I want you to speak on the difference between the European approach to regulation and the American approach to regulation. And your perspective on that, and where you think we should be going with that here in the U.S.
So there are two aspects to my answer to your question. The first thing that I was also thinking when you were mentioning this is truly how many of those devices have been tested, explored, really seen. In terms of their impact on the patient. We know all of the problems with randomized trials. We know that we need to select, as scientists, we need to select volunteers who are available to us to do the trial. That doesn't mean that that the same type of patient is actually representative for your whole population. Many of those that have been approved, many of those applications have been currently at the product development stage. And one of the things that I truly appreciate in the work of Dr. Seely and his team is the emphasis that they have on trying to understand the not only how all of the aspects that go right, but trying to explain the error where AI did something wrong. So without really having empirical evidence about the trustworthiness of these systems, I'm very much worried that if we are implementing such solutions, we're going to see also lots of harms, and some of the with some of the benefits. Now, what we need to understand is how big of a harm one of those products would be relative to the benefits, and we have very little evidence on most of those. The reason for that is that many of those product developments are not transparent to the research community. We are not invited at the table to do research and to explore the potential positive and also negative effects of these solutions. And that is the part that I would urge FDI, but all of the regulatory bodies in the world, open up for research scrutiny some of those developments that they are currently evaluating. Okay, so that's one side of my question, of my kind of answer or comment to your question. The other side is the problem that we currently are facing globally, and I'm here now, of course, speaking as a European. We have very different approaches to regulation. So the US has a more sectorial approach. And you have been talking about multidisciplinarity, multi-stakeholder approach. EU or European countries in general have taken a very different approach. They have taken an umbrella approach. Let's have one set of main kind of criteria for creating safe AI solutions and then try to apply them to different sectors. In the US, the approach has been slightly different. It has been, let's create a set of criteria and solutions for healthcare, for tax offices, etc., which is creating these sectorial differences. Both of those approaches have advantages and disadvantages. If you're thinking about disadvantages of some of those sectorial approaches, is the lack of having this big view, umbrella view, across all of the disciplines, and the lack of coordination between some of those solutions that may take longer to be implemented at the global scale or at the scale of the whole country and many different sectors. Umbrella approach, on the other side, may not be very detailed. So what I am interested to see in the future, and what I expect to see in the future, is some sort of divergence or maybe convergence between these two different approaches to regulation, and how this will play out primarily for end users like patients.
Great. So I want to share with you something that's going on in the States in this regard. And so, you know, there are certainly governmental attempts to regulate things, but the academic community in medicine has tried to address this by forming a not-for-profit organization as well. And it comes out of Duke, and it's CHAI is the name of it. And what it is the attempt of academic physicians to pull the different centers together to try to address the things that you and I are talking about. So it's called, it's basically an attempt to regulate AI in healthcare. And so what has happened here is something like this. There's these 1,000 or more FDA as medical devices. Now the hospitals and health systems have to decide, well, which ones are going to we deploy and use to care for patients and which ones are we not? Because many of them do the same thing. They're like, there's, for example, 10 different medicines I could use for your cholesterol. They're all similar. Well, there's 10 different AI algorithms that might be for the same thing. So they may not be equally good. How do we decide which one we're going to use? So hospitals and health systems are starting to create a leadership position called chief. It was chief intelligence officer, but now it's called chief AI officer. And those physicians are going to assist the big medical centers to decide which ones to purchase or and then implement and deploy. Well, because as you and I just mentioned, these haven't been tested in a rigorous scientific way the way medications are. A professor at Duke who is a chief AI officer, along with others, formed for the academic community this CHAI, CHAI. And his idea is instead of each hospital testing the AI algorithm themselves, why don't we pool our data, share, work together as we're testing these products so each hospital doesn't have to kind of do it in their own silo, that there's some collaborative approach amongst academic medical centers to do this. So have you heard about this organization? What are your thoughts on?
I have been following.
Yes.
I have been following some of these developments, and by all means, I think they are going in a very, very right direction. One difference that I would point out is the difference between voluntary recommendations and regulatory laws implemented from top down. So what we know, and I will now use a parallel to how social media regulation has actually developed, because I think we are seeing somewhat similar trends. If we really rely on voluntary applications, on voluntary self-regulation from industry, that typically in business settings does not work so well. For example, social media platforms have been heavily criticized for their lack of self-regulation in terms of the harms that that social media can cause to end users. So what I am interested to see is the impact that those organizations, like the ones that that you have been referring to, will ultimately have on the creation of these new solutions, right? If it's only voluntary recommendation and the firms developing solutions may or may not follow it, it's just voluntary for them to do it, we're going to see very different kind of world relative to the regulation that is top down. For example, someone has been using the story about using car belts, right? In the beginning, when it was voluntary, not many people were using it. Yeah. But the moment we started really applying regulations and saying you have to use it, otherwise you're going to pay a fine for not using it, then majority of people started using it, and it has become a norm for everyone entering cars now.
Right.
So
we know that seatbelts save lives. And I'll tell you, as a young person in high school, when we are given our lessons in school about driving, in an influential age, we're like essentially trained to put that seatbelt on every time when you get in that car. So it is possible to successfully do that. That is a seatbelt is such a beautiful example of a law that saves lives, millions of lives. And it's all about, properly implementing some regulation. That is fantastic. Now I want to pivot into, so we talked about governance and regulation, which is really important. The other area that we are very always concerned about is the bias piece of AI. Can you speak to that to some extent?
So there are many biases that currently are not that well known. Very often, when in public, in popular media, when we talk about biases, we talk about racial biases, for example, AI solutions treating differently different groups of people. Treating women differently than men, making very different predictions based on the race, ethnical background, etc. Many of those biases are so well entrenched into the data, historical data that we have, on which all of those AI systems have been trained, that it is very hard for anyone to really overcome some of those entrenched biases that exists in AI systems. So biases have several different sources that. Some of us know more or less about, but they're all humanly kind of created and based on human nature. We live in a society when where most of the data is socially created. It has some social consequence. Think about, for example, a person. I'm not a native English speaker, as you could see. And when I'm talking to someone in English, of course, I'm going to express myself differently than someone who is a native speaker. That, in essence, shouldn't make a different diagnosis on the same symptoms for you, Mel, and for me. But AI may pick up some of those very slight differences between us and not intentionally, but unintentionally. Use that information about these differences in order to create different solutions for myself relative to you. We know that some of the stereotypes, some of the psychological problems that all of us have, we are humans, we do have stereotypes. They're also entrenched in the data, in social media data, in lots of internet data that many of those, for example, generative AI models have been trained on. So many of those biases still exist. And they are unfortunately very hard to overcome because what we thought at first is that technically speaking, if I don't use the information that I have about your gender, whether you are female or male, if I don't use information about ethnical background, etc., then we are going to have a fair system for both of us. However, AI basically picks up all of the other small cues that gives information about my gender, my ethnical background, etc., and then uses that again to make a biased and discriminatory outcomes for us. So it's very hard to overcome some of those biases that currently exist in data and also in algorithms that we use.
Yeah, I love that. I want to give like a specific example in every single day medicine. If you were to go to a hospital today in the US, it would be a very good chance that if you were sick, you would get an X-ray, probably a chest X-ray at a minimum. And if a radiologist were to look at that chest X-ray, and not ever know you or have met you, which typically they only see the X-ray. They don't see the patient. I see the patient. I order the X-ray, but the X-ray gets sent to the radiologist. When they look at that, looking at that image, they don't know your gender. They don't know your race. They're not really biased in any way about you. They just have an image in front of them. But when we use artificial intelligence algorithm to look at that same X-ray, it can figure out 100% accuracy the gender, the race of that individual. And sometimes we don't, as physicians, sometimes we're not always sure why that may be, although people like Judy and Leo have figured out why that is. But aside from that, there's a lot of unexplainable patterns that AI can see on an X-ray that are not visible to the human eye, that it has, it's at the level of pixels and patterns that we would, as human beings, would never be able to see the complexity of the layers of the patterns that it detects. And that's in that is the hidden bias. So what would you advise doctors to do in that regard? I know that many of the people you and I work with closely are spending their entire careers on this right now, but what is your advice to someone on approaching this?
So what we have to do is use critical thinking. I know it's very easy to say, very hard to apply, but what has been happening is that all of us, particularly people using generative AI like ChatGPT, we start to see those solutions as smart solutions that are actually providing the true answer. And we stop questioning those solutions in the way that we are not questioning our calculators anymore, right? When I'm using a calculator to multiply two numbers, I don't really question whether that calculator will be correct or not. I know with very high accuracy that it's correct. Now, I'm using that same thing the more I'm interacting with a generative AI like ChatGPT, I start to assume this same correctness, the same accuracy for models that are very not accurate because they are dealing with issues that are not as specific or clear in rules as multiplying two numbers.
Right.
So what has been happening and what I am advising is that clinicians now have something very often we are getting into this bias of over-relying on the solution and thinking that that whatever this computer spits out must be a correct solution. So what I would say is always check, that's the first thing, always check whether that solution is really that has been provided to you is really applicable to the patient that you have in front of you. Because every solution is typically done for an average consumer. An average consumer we know doesn't exist because it's a combination of all of the people together, right? So when you are giving an advice, and I will round this up with one example from ChatGPT recent research that has been done. When you are giving an advice, think very carefully about how your patient, the person in front of you, may be different than the average solution that has been provided by AI. For example, ChatGPT has been asked to say which, based on the symptoms, which sort of diagnosis would be given to a patient. So they have created vignettes, type of scenarios with the same set of symptoms, exactly the same measurements, and the only thing that was changed when asked was the gender, whether it's a female or male, and the ethnical background and race, for example, whether it's a white American or Black American person. And ChatGPT in itself gave very, very different answers. So for the problems with breathing, for a cloth in lungs, if it was a male, it gave one answer, and if it was a woman, it assumed very often that it's anxiety attacked, that it's some sort of mental problem with a woman. For throat infection, it gave it was more prone to think that it's a sexual disease transmitted problem for Black patients rather than white patients. So think about how the person next to you that you are or the patient that you are dealing with may be different than the information that you have received, and think about what that information is based on. That's right. My only solution.
I love that answer. And what I want to share with you, and I'm sure you know this, is that in the last few months, the people that are physicians that are working on this at the highest level at the major medical centers, academic centers, they have been creating scenarios and feeding it into ChatGPT as a test to see what it puts out, to see how accurate it is. Or they've even another good example is that I have always taught doctors at how to think using cases from the New England Journal of Medicine. There's two kinds. One are the case records of Massachusetts General Hospital. The other is clinical problem solving. These are real cases that are published every week in the New England Journal of where we have an answer, meaning, for example, a biopsy was done or they went to surgery and a piece of tissue was removed. So in other words, we know what the truth is because under a microscope is the for sure pathological answer. And yet in the case, we talk through the steps from beginning to end of what their symptoms were, what their exam was, what the laboratory showed. But we have a definitive answer. We know what it's called now, the term that everyone's using, and I'm sure you hear this all the time, it's called ground truth. Eric Topol, actually, who is a cardiologist who's world-renowned in AI now, his podcast, like what I'm doing with you, he actually calls it ground truth, and I do listen to that. He's one of the best in the world. He is usually the keynote speaker at every AI meeting anywhere. But anyway, where I'm going with this is, back to your point, as scientists, what we need to do is, in a very scientific, rigorous research way, test the algorithm we're using with case examples, like you said, different case examples, against the ground truth, which we know we have cases where we can test it against a true ground truth, which would be proven diagnosis, where there's no discussion. We have a proven answer by a biopsy, by a surgery, by some proof, or where we have multiple experts in that field that all agree that this is the ground truth. And if we can rigorously test each AI algorithm against a ground truth, then we'll have the true science and we'll deliver good patient care that we could feel great about, that we could feel is safe, that we could feel is not biased in any way, that is ethical. So I want to end, because we're going to end in a few minutes. I wanted to do something. I just thought of what I want to do at the end, and hopefully you'll be on board, because I didn't prepare you for this. But I'm going to be spending the next several decades working on how do we use AI to help patients for good. And I know that you are going to be in this space as well. You're one of the top thought leaders that I've ever met in this area. I love having these conversations with you. I want you to give me, it doesn't have to be 10, but let's say 10 pearls from Matilda to Mel on advice for me in navigating through these uncharted waters of the future of AI, as specifically in medicine. What would be the tools, the things that the pearls of wisdom that I should apply, the principles to allow me to do this well, to benefit patients worldwide for good?
Oh, now I'm put on the spot. I don't know whether all of those are pearls, but there are some of the thoughts that I have in my head that I think will be relevant for the future. So first, now that we were talking about grand truth, what I would like all of us to think about is, what is the grand truth? What we know is that most of these big AI solutions have been actually tested on all of the encyclopedia and all of the papers from top journals that have the solution. So they know what the solution is. And then we are saying, how accurate these systems are, we are testing based on how many times they will correctly answer things that they are already trained on. So what we will have to do in the next stage, as one of these pros, is to actually see in what other ways can we test the true accuracy and the true benefits and the usefulness of these solutions. That's one of the aspects that I think will be relevant. The second thing that will be very important in the future is to try to define what are the metrics of transparency that we as patients, as users, as researchers, as society in general, want to adopt for all of the models and for all of the applications that exist. Does this transparency metric include some of the understanding of the potential risks, the potential harms that we have? How are we defining what companies, what organizations are supposed to do? How transparent their practices should be, how transparent their models should be, and who is there to actually test some of those models. The second thing, I don't know whether I have 10 of them, but these are the issues that I think will be very relevant for the future. The second or the third one is how are we going to deal with privacy? The more privacy we impose into these models, unfortunately, what we see is that it doesn't really always that privacy protection doesn't always protect those that are the most vulnerable. If you take away the information about the background, all of these sensitive features that we have been talking about, we see that the solutions will be even more unfair towards those minority groups. So how do we overcome, how do we balance protection of human rights with the developments and useful benefits of AI? And one of the things that I think would be very relevant for the future is the discussion about regulation versus productivity gains. I think that US versus European model of regulating AI very much differs based on this cultural assumption of what do we put first? Do we put first the productivity gains, the improvements in economic benefits versus regulation of potential harms that, for example, European Union is doing? But both of those are coming at a cost because the regulation, as European Union sees it, and the implementation of regulation has actually harmed the productivity gains in the EU. And EU is currently very worried about how are we going to compete globally against China and the US if we regulate in this way, because then we are hurting the innovation. On the other side, if you really push forward the innovation at any costs and the competition, we may end up in the society that may not look or sound or be the society that we wish to live in as a humanity in the future. So we have to find a way to actually balance these two things. I'm afraid that in the future we are going to see much more diversity between Europe and US based on the current regulations and the current political developments. But I hope that after this kind of separation of the parts, we're going to find a very good, optimistic future where both of those parts in parallel go together for the humanity.
Great. Matilda, thank you for the work that you do worldwide in the area of artificial intelligence and essentially being the one to protect all of us. I feel so much safer having you watch over me in this regard. Thanks for supporting the work that we do in our not-for-profit American College of Physicians and and being a thought leader in AI and medicine and being willing to continue this conversation with me ongoing on how we as a society worldwide are going to be the those that keep our patients safe and keep them well and find a way to implement AI in a way that's for the good of patients, not for just economic gain. We're all about, let's do it for the good of patients. And also, my hope and vision is that in the work that we do, that it allows those who don't have good access to care or are underserved to all of a sudden have access to very good care that they otherwise wouldn't get in a safe way that's to their benefit. So you and I have like societal good as our driving force, not our own personal economic gain. I think that's why we get along so well and we enjoy the conversations that we have. But it's been a pleasure having you on a podcast. And I really look forward to many more of these conversations in the years ahead and making a real difference in patients worldwide. So thank you for all that you do.
Thank you, Mel, and thank you for these very kind words. Let's make this world better. I think we can, and I'm optimistic that we can. I think ultimately we're going to see a better world, the world that that is able to combine both the benefits of AI, but also protect us from some of the risks that we currently face. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you like what you heard today, you can follow the podcast every 2 weeks. It's broadcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you might get your podcasts. Also, consider attending our national scientific session here in Chicago, which will be Friday, September 19th, and Saturday, September 20th. We will be focusing on the evidence-based medicine of patient care and the issues that were discussed today about governance, bias, ethical implications. So if these topics are important to you and you want an in-depth discussion with world leaders about this, think about attending our conference in Chicago in September 2025. Stay warm, everyone. Have a great day. Bye.
If you enjoyed what you heard here today, consider becoming a member of our professional society by going to www.americancollegeaim.org and click join. Also, don't forget to save the dates. September 19th and 20th, 2025, we'll be having our first ever scientific session at McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Go to our website to register to attend the conference. We hope to see you all live in Chicago, and we look forward to having you tune in to our next podcast on Melvin Monday here on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.